Alaska Airlines Chief Executive Officer Bruce Kennedy says the Eskimo symbol was just too popular to drop, although the company had thought about it a few years ago, resulting in major public outcry. Kennedy says the most noticeable change on the exterior of the fleet of planes will be the company's new logo.
We think when the customers look at the airplane design, they're going to see two things primarily. First, they're going to see the Eskimo still on the tail, and they're going to identify that that's the Alaska Airlines that they've known and come to trust over the years. And they're going to look at the color scheme, and they're going to say, well, that's familiar. That's still Alaska, the blues and the greens and the whites. That's still Alaska. But then they're going to see the bold portrayal of our corporate name splashed in a brushstroke on the side of the fuselage. And they're going to say, that's the bold new Alaska Airlines. That's the Alaska Airlines that flies from Prudhoe Bay to Acapulco.
The paint job isn't the only change for Alaska Airlines. The interior of the company jets are also receiving an updated look, along with new ticket counters, airline uniforms, even business cards and swizzle sticks. The seats and bulkheads will feature design patterns inspired by native art from Alaska and the Southwest. The made-over jet will be shown off in Fairbanks, Juneau, Sitka, and Ketchikan on Wednesday with a low flyby over Petersburg and Wrangell. It will go into regular service on Thursday. Kennedy says two more aircraft should finish their makeovers within a month, but it should take about 2 years to finish refitting the rest of the fleet. I'm Valerie Ng in Petersburg.
This Friday, the NCSL's Energy Committee is hosting a forum on a national energy policy, the country's growing dependence on imported oil, and a one-year-after look at the Exxon Valdez spill. The presentation on the oil spill might have gone unnoticed if Fairbanks Representative Mike Davis hadn't called to ask about it. Davis recalled that a year ago there had been a major discussion of the spill, and he wondered if there'd be any interest this year. He says he was told that there was a discussion planned titled Life After the Oil Spill, and that it would include just two speakers, Richard Rabinow of Exxon and James Hermiller of Alyeska Pipeline Service Company.
So I was frankly very surprised to find out that the presentation this year was going to be by Exxon and Alyeska, period. You know, and then I said, well, who's the chairman? And they said, well, it's Jan Fakes. And I went, oh, well, I guess I should have known that.
Senator Jan Fakes is in charge of NCSL's Energy Committee this year and put together the oil spill presentation. The Anchorage Republican has been a strong supporter of the oil industry. This year, the Senate Judiciary Committee, which Fakes chairs, weakened an oil spill bill designed to beef up state environmental enforcement powers. The bill eventually died in another committee. Calls to Fakes at the Arlington Hotel where she's staying were not returned Tuesday. Davis has been scrambling to put together his own presentation for the conference, one that he hopes goes beyond the oil industry perspective.
How the legislation, frankly, was weakened, I think, in terms of providing protection for the environment, the heavy lobbying that took place as we discuss these pieces of legislation.
But Davis doesn't know if he'll get a chance to make his presentation. He has to get the approval of the committee chairwoman, Jan Fakes, first. In Juneau, I'm Peter Kenyon.
3, 2, 1. School board member Carl Schroeder thinks teachers in the Fairbanks North Star Borough School District should take a basic knowledge and skills test. Even though the state doesn't mandate teacher testing, Schroeder says the community here supports it, and he thinks the Fairbanks district should require such tests. Schroeder wanted the school board to pass a resolution last night that would have required teacher testing here. What he got instead was a compromise resolution that recognizes such tests rather than require them.
The portion of it that would have directed the administration to do it in Fairbanks, whether anybody else did it or not, was deleted. And it's for the same issue. The same issue here is the same issue why we don't have seat belts in school buses and why we don't test teachers is because we're afraid somebody's going to sue us and we're going to lose. Or even if we don't lose, we're going to have to defend ourselves, and it's going to cost a lot of money because this is of a litigious society.
Other school board members and the administration were concerned that the issue of teacher testing hasn't been researched enough to put in practice here. And since the state doesn't require it, Fairbanks would be breaking relatively new ground that could face a challenge here. The resolution that did pass asks the Alaska Department of Education to require testing for teacher certification. Schroeder even went along with the change when it became clear his original plan didn't have the votes to pass, when he says he supports the board's decision. For KUAC Local News, I'm Ann Thornson. 3, 2, 1. Summer means tourists, bicycling, barbecues, and sports to most of us, but for residents of the Northward Building downtown, it means something more. More people and more noise. The early evenings offer pretty typical street sounds. In fact, the late night does too. In the winter, when things are quieter, windows are closed anyway. But windows go up when things warm up, and so do complaints about the noise. Fairbanks Police Chief Richard Cummings.
It's lighter out. Kids are out all night. People that live in the residential areas, because of they want to live like anyone else, and so they open their windows in the summer to allow fresh air, and the noise just permeates up the buildings and into the windows, so it sounds like total chaos.
Cummings says over the years, as more bars have been torn down, the crowd has shifted, moving closer to places where people live, like the Northward Building.
It's focused all the activity on the 400 block of 2nd Avenue, closer to the residential areas. And probably, since there's less bars, there's more people and more activity around those bars.
It's kind of fascinating sometimes just to sit and watch the action, because it was a steady stream down back and forth on the sidewalk. But later in the evening, it would, you couldn't sleep with your window open because it would just keep you awake, hollering and screaming. Going.
And this went on till like 5, 6, 7 o'clock in the morning.
Harold and Claudia Berge live on the south side of the Northward Building, where things are fairly quiet. But late last summer, they made a temporary home on the other side of the building while their apartment was being painted. And they got to see and hear what was going on firsthand.
And you walk out there to your car, and right behind that building, there were always 10, 12 people maybe, or one or two, sleeping. Sleeping the night before. And smelling and urinating.
Most of the activity is going on outside the building. Inside, there's a security officer on the job to keep the building safe and the lobby free of loiterers. But Harold Berge says residents have had to do a little policing in the past.
A little over a year ago, there was quite a bit of quite a few problems around downtown with people dealing in dope. And we had our time in here with it. They would come in and go in the elevators and go up here on the floors and do their dealing and right in the elevators. And a lot of times I would be getting in and I'd have to chase them out of the building. You know, just say we had a list of 86 people out of here. And but these were younger people in these black like trench coats. You know, they had this fad going on.
The Berges have only lived in the building since 1984, but for Claudia, it was a trip back home.
I had an apartment here in 1953, and the area has changed so much since then. It's just incredible. I still like the building. I think this building is kind of like a mother hen or something. It's like going to work for Boeing in a way, where Boeing takes care of you. Now, I get this feeling about this building.
Another person who loves the building is Peggy Hansen, one of the first people to move in back in 1953.
I raised my family here most of the time. They're all gone now. But it's the people in the apartment that's real good to me. You know what I mean? I couldn't be happy anyplace else.
Hansen loves it even though she's noticed changes in the downtown area. The crowd has changed too. But Hansen says she doesn't really mind some of the things that the other residents may not like.
I don't know. I guess it has been bad sometimes, but not for me. And I never complain on anybody. Really, I don't. I just, I went out the door the other night, and I opened the door, and a girl fell in the door. But she was just sitting there crying. It scared her more than it did me. She just didn't know where to go, and she was lost. So she just sat by my door. And when I opened it, naturally, she fell in. So now when I see her, she was raised to me, and she says, I love you. I love you. You didn't turn me in. Well, what was I to turn her in for? She hadn't done anything, you know.
On a recent Friday night, activity around 3rd and Lacey Streets is pretty steady. The foot traffic follows a pattern from one bar to another. Things pick up as it gets dark, but by morning, it is quieter. Trash bag after trash bag is taken out of the back door of the Savoy Bar as closing preparations begin around 4 o'clock. Even before the bar shut down, things are fairly quiet. A police car stopped to break up some activity, and after that, pedestrian traffic comes to a virtual standstill. Probably no night can be considered typical on the streets of Fairbanks, but this night hasn't been too busy for a Friday. Now, as the summer months approach and there's more daylight, people will want to be out, and that means the volume will go up. For KUAC Local News, I'm Ann Thornson. 3, 2, 1. The Local Boundary Commission is looking at how to divide the state's one large unincorporated borough into separate boroughs. The ideal boundary study is part of that effort. This weekend's hearings cover suggested boundaries for potential boroughs in the Yukon Flats, Yukon Koyukuk, and Iditarod school districts. Dan Bockhorst with the State Department of Community and Regional Affairs worked on the proposed boundary lines. He says the configurations for the suggested boroughs follow the regional educational attendance area boundaries, with a few exceptions.
In the case of the Yukon Flats, our recommendation is to exclude that portion of the Yukon Flats region, which is included within the territory that we feel is part of the ideal boundaries of the Fairbanks North Star Borough. That specifically includes the communities of Live and Good, Central, Circle Hot Springs, the White Mountain National Recreation Area, and the Cease Conservation Area. So that's a deviation in the Yukon Flats region. In the Yukon Koyukuk region, we would propose to exclude from those boundaries the territory that was included in the ideal boundaries of the Denali Borough, which the Commission set on April 21st in Healy. And essentially that includes the area around the community of Nenana.
Bockhorst says the Iditarod Borough boundaries would be changed slightly too because of the recommended Denali Borough, but no populated areas would be affected by that change. Comments on the department's recommended ideal boundary for the Fairbanks North Star Borough will also be taken. That includes extending the borough's northern boundary line. The borough wanted to annex some 200 miles, including a pipeline pump station. Instead, Bockhorst says the department recommended a bigger area for annexation to include some people, namely the residents of Live and Good, Central, and Circle Hot Springs. The borough's community planning director, Rex Nutter, has been handling questions on the local hearing.
Most of the questions that we have received have been regarding, did we ask for Live and Good, did we ask for Central Circle area, and my response has been no, that was the recommendation put forth by the Department of Community and Regional Affairs. Our original request was simply the 216 square miles north of our current border. The recommendation out of the Assembly is that the Assembly will only provide services to that area greater than what we originally requested if those people ask for it. And presently our understanding is they are not interested in being annexed.
Nutter says since the borough does not support the proposed new boundary line that was drawn up by the DCRA, he expects the Local Boundary Commission to reject the suggestion. That could possibly put those three communities back in a proposed Yukon Flats borough. The hearings themselves will include a network of teleconferences to cover all the rural villages. The DCRA's Bockhorst says that will allow everyone access.
On Friday, the commission will be in McGrath, and there will be approximately 9 communities hooked up by teleconference, every community in the Iditarod region. Another group of commission members will be in Tananaw on Friday evening, and all 13 or 14 other communities in the Yukon-Koyukuk region will be connected by teleconference. And then on Sunday, the commission will be in Fort Yukon and will connect all the 10 or so communities in the Yukon Flats region.
A designated teleconference site has been set for each of the rural communities. Saturday's hearings in Live and Good and Fairbanks will not be teleconferenced. Neither will the hearing in Central on Sunday night. Bockhorst says the hearings are designed just to talk about boundaries. He says a form of government or the tax base for any new borough are separate issues. Right now, the Local Boundary Commission just wants to look at the common interest elements outlined in the state constitution for any borough, things like social, cultural, and economic relationships that are shared by communities, as well as geography and transportation links. Bockhorst says whether the areas satisfy economic viability concerns can be looked at later. For now, they just want to talk boundaries, not whether a community wants, needs, or can afford an organized borough. For KUAC Local News, I'm Ann Thornton. Reporting from Fairbanks, I'm Ann Thornton.
Handing out his letter of intent to file for Lieutenant Governor to reporters at the Capitol, Kelly said he's not teaming up with any candidate, but he clearly sought to identify his candidacy with the current gubernatorial frontrunner, Arla Sterjulewski.
I fully expect Senator Sterjulewski to be the next governor of the state of Alaska. I've always had a very good working relationship with Arla, and I think I would have a major role in any administration that that Arla would bring to this state.
The other announced Republican lieutenant governor candidates are Nenana Senator Jack Coghill, Anchorage businessman Don Smith, and Anchorage contractor Glenn Fredericks. Kelly expects to spend about $200,000 in the primary, and says he's already got half of that in his war chest. When asked if he would voluntarily abide by the stricter campaign finance rules contained in the ethics bill that failed this session, Kelly at first rejected the idea, saying he'd play by the existing rules until somebody changed them. But he added that if the other candidates would agree to the more ethical campaign finance standards, he would too. Kelly's decision sets off a domino effect for that district. Representatives Sam Cotton, Randy Phillips, Ramona Barnes, and Walt Furness could all seek Kelly's Senate seat. Cotton was noncommittal, saying he's giving the entire question of public service deep thought. Phillips said he's tempted, but if it looks like the Republicans are going to take over the House, he might stay where he is. Barnes and Furness could not be reached for comment. The political shakeup may have some far-reaching consequences. With four senators running for statewide office and a number of House seats likely to come open as well, both the Republican majority in the Senate and the Democratic edge in the House may be up for grabs this fall. In Juneau, I'm Peter Kenyon.
3, 2, 1. Even though the deal isn't ready, Railroad Corporation President Frank Turpin says he asked for preliminary approval from the board of directors.
The conceptual approval means that if Princess Tours can meet the covenants and the desires that we have for making this really a beautiful spot, why then they will approve their lease. It means that we're willing to develop this property into hotel and other appropriate facilities.
And the Princess Tours Hotel on the northern bank of the Chena River could be just the start of development. Railroad commissioners also want to know more about who will make utilities accessible to the land and how much capacity they'll have.
When we bring utilities in for the single hotel, we also have to anticipate whether we will have restaurants or what we will have there. And the utilities would have to be large enough to accommodate all of the things that we plan to put in that area.
Thinking about the increase in traffic, railroad commissioners also wanted to know about road access to the land. The 80 acres there offers plenty of room for more, including the possibility of a new railroad depot. Turpin says traffic congestion is making things difficult at the Fairbanks Depot now, and this property is one of a few options they could consider in locating a new depot.
We have reached the conclusion that we must find another location for the depot. Now, there are several possibilities, I guess. One would be in the yard somewhere in Fairbanks, and that doesn't thrill me at all because it's not a very good place to handle traffic or people in the middle of a yard. Another one that we have talked about is to go completely out of town to College Station or by the university. And another alternate then would be to use this property, a portion of this property, for a depot. And that seems to me to be as convenient as any, but a greater plus is the fact that if you have a beautiful piece of property there, it gives the arriving tourist a very good impression of Fairbanks, rather than dumping them in a railroad yard or someplace like that.
Railroad Commissioner Frank Chapados lives in Fairbanks. He supports the development and says he wants to make sure things are done right.
I think the idea is great. I think Fairbanks is very receptive to it, and I think the Green Belt is important. I think that I want to see it more than 100 feet personally, because somehow or another those Green Belts always seem to get cut down, and the first thing you know, you can see a lot of things on the other side that really doesn't enhance your own property if you're on the cross the river from them.
For now, the railroad commissioners have given Turpin the okay to negotiate a contract with Princess Tours for its $12 million hotel development. The preliminary okay means the company can get some of its initial work started. The railroad board will consider finalizing that lease when it gets a better picture of what's planned for the land at its July board meeting in Seward. For KUAC Local News, I'm Ann Thornton. 3, 2, 1. Nearly $9 million was approved for the new elementary school on the Post. Representative Mike Davis originally sponsored a $33 million bill to take care of all the on-base school needs. Davis says the Fort Wainwright Elementary was considered to be perhaps the greatest need.
The military people identified Fort Wainwright as the highest priority of schools that needed to be funded across the state. And also the governor realized the necessity of that school and placed it into the governor's budget. That really helped to sort of galvanize the support.
Fort Wainwright schools are already packed, with the district planning to move some of those students off base this fall to less crowded buildings. But school superintendent Rick Cross says the new school should be ready in a couple of years. The site is already chosen, and they'll use the same design as Tickasick Brown and University Park Elementary Schools.
We hope that the school will open 2 years from this fall, and that we'll be moving the students that will be going off post next year back on in 2 years. And we also hope that we will be able to build another school on Fort Wainwright with federal dollars that will make us be able to meet all the needs there.
Cross says he's optimistic the federal government will provide the money for the second school, since the state committed to build the first one. And that wasn't a simple accomplishment, according to Cross. Last fall, voters here rejected the idea of building a new school in the northern part of Fairbanks. Even though this is an entirely different school project, Cross says that bond election made the school a tough sell.
It was not easy to convince the state to appropriate the money for that school in the face of that failed bond election. But a lot of people worked on it, and we got it.
Another thing Fairbanks got from the state legislature this year is money for the natural science building at UAF after years of trying. Representative Davis says the university also got some funds to take care of other maintenance problems, too.
The total university funding in maintenance and new construction is around $70 million for the university. And that's up from some years where they've had only around $1 million.
$23 million was approved for the natural sciences building, home for geology, geophysics, physics, and chemistry departments. Project manager Janet Matheson says a little more money is actually needed for the entire proposal, but this will get a lot of it done.
We are hoping that with the accrued interest, we'll be able to restore the items that we won't be able to include in the building. At this time, it looks as though the lab furnishings and equipment would have to be put on alternate, and we'll have to see if we have the funds to award them when it comes time to open the bids.
The building construction would likely begin next spring, Matheson says. They hope to have it ready by the summer of 1992. The white three-story structure is to be built on Yukon Drive between the upper dorms and the U.S. Geological Survey's observatory. Other major capital projects that the legislature approved include $29 million for the Healy Coal Power Plant. That will enable the Healy Coal Project to get a $90 million federal grant. Also, more than $1 million was okayed for a new Fairbanks Health Center. For KUAC Local News, I'm Ann Thornson.
UTC's initial offer to the city was, we will not hold the city responsible for any of our costs and attorney's fees, and we will forget about this whole thing and walk away from it. We felt we had some claims that we could pursue, that we had some justifiable claims against UTC, and therefore we would not accept the offer of simply walking away from the lawsuit.
The council is going to argue over that, apparently. It's my feeling that that should go back to where it came from, which is wastewater treatment. They've been funding the litigation of Tekite. And whether we have the votes to do that or not, I don't know. We should be getting the funds, I believe, in 4 weeks approximately. And after that, I think the city manager will ask us for direction on what to do with the money. It's a pleasant problem for a change.
Three, two, one. 2 weeks ago, Borough Mayor Juanita Helms wrote a letter raising several questions about how the count is being conducted here and blamed the Census Bureau for Fairbanks' poor response rate so far. That letter was sent to Regional Director Leo Schilling, and he was here yesterday to give some answers firsthand. Schilling believes the count is on track here, despite some confusion about the whole process.
Well, one of the reasons we came up here is you know, we saw people concerned about the accuracy of the census. We have absolutely no concern about those things. We don't feel that everything has gone perfectly by any means, but these are not critical things to the census. They would have been nice things to accomplish, but we didn't, but we didn't rely on them either. And so we're on track for a good census.
Schilling says some of the perceived problems may be because the census is conducting things in three different ways here. Some people got a census form in the mail and were told to mail them back. Others received forms in the mail but were told to hold on to them. Others, like people in North Pole, never got anything in the mail. They'll get a personal visit from a Census Bureau official instead. Schilling says it's been confusing because of the three different things that have been going on in this area, but he thinks enough follow-up will be done to make sure everyone is counted.
The primary thing is that the mail-out is something that helps the census, but we don't rely on the census. We design it in such a way that if the mail-out has a problem with it, that there are other things that will guarantee the completeness of the census. In the city of Fairbanks, that's our mailing list, which we feel was very complete going into the census. And the fact that we didn't get a questionnaire to every one of those housing units doesn't mean that they're coming off of our mailing list. They're on that list, and we're going to call on everyone that we haven't received a questionnaire from.
Schilling says there are also checks in place to make sure people won't be double counted if they happen to mail back two forms. Currently, census workers are still doing personal follow-up visits, going to households that did not return or receive a questionnaire. People who were told to hang on to their forms and wait for a personal visit should get that visit by the end of next week. And if they still don't reach everyone, Schilling says there is an ad campaign scheduled in June to ask people if they were counted and what to do if you think you've been missed. Deborah Randall came to town with Schilling. She's in charge of the Anchorage District Census Office and was here the night of the homeless count in March. The way that was conducted still bothers Eileen Cummings, who is the local head of the State Homeless Coalition. Cummings doesn't feel the effort was coordinated enough here to get a good count of the homeless. But Randall says they tried to get a good idea of who was on the streets of Fairbanks that night.
We were given street locations by people within the municipality, and we did go to those locations. We either traveled around the block or we got out of our automobiles and stood on the street corner, and we did this on at least three or four different occasions. I mean, if we would go around like at 1 o'clock or 2 o'clock, and then we would return like at 2:30. And so we did this repeatedly throughout the evening until 6 a.m. Most people were moving from one location to another, which we also found that we were repeating people. In other words, we would pick them up at 2 or 3, and then they would reappear again at 4 as one place closed down or a lobby of a hotel was closing down, and they would be moving. They seem to have a little circuit that they take. So once we started to recognize the people, we tried not, of course, to recount them again.
And Randall also feels they got a very good response to attempts to count people in homeless shelters that night. Leslie Corvola, who learned firsthand of some of the problems here, said after the meeting yesterday she feels reassured the Census Bureau is getting a good count. Corvola faces a bigger problem now. Her community research center, which analyzes the Census Bureau figures, is targeted for elimination under recommendations by the Borough Assembly's Finance Committee.
One of my deep concerns here at the Borough has been that if they follow through with the recommended cuts that are now in the budget, there will not be a community research center to do the review work. That could be a disaster for the community. It's a safety net that's in place and was well planned, but if it's not funded, it won't work. So there is that problem. And that's not completely resolved, because although there's been strong testimony and support of this work, there's no money yet. And so we have to still work through that. There will be a review process carried out within the borough.
Corvola says she fears if the Community Research Center isn't around to review the census work for the borough, it's a job that won't get done. For KUAC Local News, I'm Ann Thornson. Testimony picked up where it left off last week with School Board President Jerry Macbeth. Assembly members heard support for the same things that were brought up during last week's public hearing, too. The crowd was smaller, but the PTA was well represented. Many parents wearing blue buttons offered testimony supporting the school district's full funding request of $22.3 million local dollars.
That locally elected school board told you it needs $22.3 million for fiscal year 91. Borough spending is well within the tax cap, yet your budget subcommittee has denied the school board's recommendation. My question is why? Has some information been kept from you by the local board? What causes you, as one set of elected officials, to second-guess the officials elected to oversee the schools?
Unless you've been actively participating in schools, been involved in the activities, been there day-to-day on the scene in the trenches, I think it may be hard for you to really understand what is going on. And I believe it's in your best interest to recognize the expertise of those who have put the budget together.
Please take the time to visit the schools and to look into these programs a little more fully. I've noticed there have been a lot of questions about some of these programs, and I feel that you should be familiarizing yourself more fully with our school district to appreciate what a great educational system we have here in the community.
If the school district budget is cut, I think what will be cut are programs that directly affect children's learning. I think that the administration of our school district has been extremely responsible and that they have pared their budget down to the point of being sparse. If you tie their hands, you can't expect them to do the job. I feel that their budget is prudent and it should be funded in full.
I don't think there have just been continual add-ons. There have been reductions at central office that I've watched. I've heard teachers talk about how they don't have, you know, they can't go to the science specialist at central office, et cetera, anymore because the people aren't there. But what I'm trying to tell you is I think the changes have been good, that there are differences between the budgets we used to have and the budgets that we have now, and I think they're responsible, and I think they're things that make a difference for kids.
A letter from the Council of PTAs was also read to the Borough Assembly with 500 names on a petition asking that the school district be given all the money requested from the borough. There were also a handful of people who testified in support of budget cuts for both the borough and the school district.
There's too much money going into government. I haven't followed the budget stroke by stroke, but I know, having seen this circus go on for about 15, 20 some years up here, there is a lot of waste in the government.
If you don't believe that you were elected to reduce this budget, keep the pressure down. Go back and listen to your campaign speeches, some of your television spots, and look at the results. You were not elected by 150 or so people that came down here to testify. You were elected by quite a few more people in this borough.
You people are not spending your own money. You're spending other people's money. I believe it is your job to spend as little of that money as you absolutely have to.
In my opinion, the school district is already overfunded. They have more than enough money to provide our children with a first-class academic education, and they're not doing it.
One woman specifically spoke against the Community Research Center. She has an applied research and statistical consulting business and says the borough is one of her greatest competitors. But there were a number of people who urged the assembly to keep the center open, and many believe the mayor's proposed budget was fine without the $6 million in cuts that were suggested by the Finance Committee.
I choose to live in an area where there are services. I want to pay for these services.
Is there to be a tax cut?
I don't want a tax cut. We have a tax cap.
I believe that the budgets probably were too high in the past. I think that that has been corrected. And now my philosophy would be that your cuts probably go too far the other way.
I don't see a mandate from the community to make such drastic cuts.
And the assembly also got a little bit of a scolding from longtime Fairbanks resident and teacher Joe Scott.
In my business, what I'm doing in this community, I would fail if I were as, and I hate this word, but I'm going to use it, if I were as snotty to people as some of you are to each other. I wouldn't stand it if I were your teacher. And I'd like to come down sometime and help you, guide you about how to work together in a creative way, because it can be done.
More than 90 people have testified on the proposed budget. Many others have written letters to the assembly or are still waiting to speak. The public hearing resumes again at 6 o'clock Thursday night. And after all the comments are in, the assembly will begin budget deliberations. For KUAC Local News, I'm Ann Thornson.
Oh, I think this is a small system, but it's a lot of energy. I don't think the tasks it faces can really be measured by the student body. My feeling is both the challenges and the prospects are quite great. So I don't see it as a diminishment in job. If anything, I see it as equally as challenging, if not more challenging.
Three, two, one. After a while, it got to be routine. Assemblymember Joe Ryan, or Donna Gilbert, or Harold Gillum, or Bonnie Williams makes a motion to reduce some portion of the budget. You hear resistance from Don Lowell and John Davies, but the majority votes, with some variations, to recommend the cut. The majority of the assembly that met over the weekend was in a budget-cutting mood. Final action, though, won't come until later. Assemblymembers seem to have two goals in mind. They want to reduce the borough mill rate overall. They also wanted to find about $1 million more in the budget to keep the dumpster service in place. They did that. And there were a couple of other recommended additions besides the money for dumpsters. A recycling group could get some more support from the borough, and the library might too. Assemblymember Bonnie Williams pushed for a new assistant librarian and more money for library materials.
56% of the citizens here are card-carrying members of the library. 56%. That's almost as many people as you got to vote against the sales tax. Now, please, guys, let's give a little something here, not just take away all day.
But the library is one of only a few favored areas. Most others could have some big cuts in store. The school district, asking for $22.3 million local tax dollars again this year, would get less than $20 million under the Assembly's recommendation. School Board President Jerry Macbeth sat through the debate and says if the recommendation holds, it will be difficult to cut things that wouldn't directly affect students.
I believe that in this case the school district has been extraordinarily responsible. It is asking no more money from the Assembly this year than it got in previous 4 years. There is no other part of borough government that has made such slight demands, it seems to me, on the community as a whole.
Funds for other borough departments could be reduced substantially, and the 9-member committee recommendation is that the Community Research Center be done away with altogether, with some grant money okayed for anyone else who wants to do that job. The Public Works Department would get an extensive overhaul, losing several employees. Preliminary numbers show 43 new and old jobs recommended for deletion altogether, including a couple of department directors.
I didn't expect them to do things like eliminate our purchasing agent.
Borough Mayor Juanita Helms sat by both days while the Assembly took the red pen to her budget.
I think that's real short-sighted, and it's going to ultimately cost the borough a lot of money.
Helms voiced sympathy for her employees, who she says now have to wait to learn their fate. She also thinks if the Assembly's preliminary actions hold up, some employees could have grounds for legal action.
The Assembly can't say so-and-so isn't doing their job, so we're going to eliminate their position. And that has been done here in the last day and a half. I think the borough is vulnerable, and those people may have paid retirement on the borough because of it.
Helms sounded disappointed after listening to the budget debate, hearing line item after line item addressed specifically for reduction. She sued the Assembly last winter because she felt Assembly members were overstepping their legislative bounds and trying to do her job. Now Helms regrets agreeing to settle that lawsuit.
I don't think they understand. I don't think it settled anything. I think they think that because we settled that lawsuit, somehow I'm capitulating and that I'm saying I was all wrong. I thought I was making a compromise. Apparently, I gave up everything by settling, and I'm sorry I did it.
The full Assembly will take formal action on the proposed budget reductions later this month. Public testimony on the Finance Committee recommendations will be taken Tuesday night, beginning at 6 o'clock. For KUAC Local News, I'm Ann Thornson. Three, two, one. The budget process has taken a slightly different route this year, one which should make it clear which direction the Assembly wants to take on the budget. In past years, the Finance Committee has made recommendations about the mayor's budget, and then public hearings were held. It wasn't until after that that the full Assembly decided what changes to make. This year, all of the Assembly members have been taking part in a series of budget work sessions. On Saturday, they'll hold one long session to agree on their budget recommendations. That means by the time of Tuesday night's public hearing, the public should have a pretty clear idea of what the majority of Assembly members plan to do. Finance Committee Chairman Chris Birch says that was one reason the change was made.
In the past, we've basically waited until the evening of the public hearing to make revisions to the budget. It was felt that by making some recommendations in advance of the public hearing, that the public would have a better grasp or a better understanding of what the Assembly intended to adopt by way of an approved budget for the year.
During work sessions, questions about the budget have zeroed in on justification for specific budget increases. The mayor's budget recommends spending nearly $67 million next year. The school district asked for more than $22 million of that. Assembly members have already said schools won't get any less than $18 million from local taxes, but how high the Assembly will go on school district spending will be decided Saturday. Two Assembly members haven't been shy about their plans to try to make some budget cuts, Donna Gilbert and Joe Ryan.
Oh, I've general overall goal to take the fat out of this budget. I found it in many different departments. I don't plan on decreasing any services to the people in the borough. I think it can be done a lot more efficiently.
One of the specific services that Assembly members want to continue is the dumpster service, which the mayor has not included in her budget, saying the borough can't afford it. Donna Gilbert's been focusing on many budget expenses she doesn't like, especially money that's been budgeted by many departments for training.
I think what it is another perk. You know, 6 days to Georgia just happens to be in the winter, and 6 days here and 7 days there, and I think it needs to be looked at very seriously, you bet.
Harold Gillum also thinks some things can come out of the budget.
Oh, I'd like to see it come down about $5 million.
But Gillum thinks realistically they probably won't be able to cut $1 million from the budget. Whether or not the majority of the Assembly thinks the budget should be cut remains to be seen on Saturday. And the public will have a chance to comment on the outcome at the public hearing scheduled Tuesday night, May the 8th. For KUAC Local News, I'm Ann Thornton.
It's another case of federal law finally trickling down to Alaska. 18 months ago, Congress decided to lift some of the restrictions on radio and television stations broadcasting ads for charitable gambling events, but the word did not reach state regulators until early this year. Now the head of the State Division of Occupational Licensing, Randall Burns, says he supports a drive by some legislators to put a moratorium on that advertising in Alaska before the ban is lifted effective next Tuesday.
I think the public needs to sort of have a good idea about what it would be like to suddenly have both on commercial television and on radio all of these pull tab parlors and bingo parlors and other activities being advertised on the airwaves, and whether or not that's something the public's really interested in having occur.
Naturally, commercial broadcasters are upset by the moratorium, and what's more galling to broadcasters like Dennis Egan is that the state ban on electronic advertising is tied to a bill letting public broadcasters conduct games of chance on the air to raise operating money. Egan, who owns two commercial radio stations in Juneau, has been buttonholing lawmakers ever since the two proposals got married in the House last month.
Separate the issues. Let the Alaska Public Radio Network conduct their charitable gaming, and let Alaska's commercial broadcasters compete in the free enterprise system. And then, if something's wrong, and if all these fears that are perceived happen, then do something.
But that argument has fallen on deaf ears so far. The House has approved a six-month moratorium, and the Senate is toying with one lasting a year. Representative Dave Donnelly of Anchorage says he supports the temporary ban on advertising while experts sort out the new federal rules.
It's a real confusing issue because an awful lot of the permits up here for charitable gaming are being run by operators. And it seems to us that the federal law would not allow them to advertise, but would allow those gaming activities that are not run by people who are making money off the games to operate. It's really confusing.
The flip side of this confusion for lawmakers is a request by the Alaska Public Radio Network for permission to air a fundraising program based around a game of chance. The network's president, Diane Kaplan, says she's been working on the idea for several years to supplement money granted APRN and its member stations by the state.
Peter Frid from K2 and I went over to Denmark last June to look at what they were doing, because they've been doing it the longest and are very sophisticated in how they do this on-air gaming. And what they did was 10 one-hour TV programs. They were on every Saturday night, and each week they took the show to a different place in Denmark. And it was a big entertainment extravaganza with all the big stars in Denmark. And then in the middle of the entertainment show, they did this drawing.
So, don't look for commercial stations to be hawking games of chance anytime soon, but like this sample from Denmark, Alaska's public stations may be entering the sweepstakes for your gambling dollars sometime down the line. The bill doing all this is pending in the state Senate now. In Juneau, I'm John Greeley.
Three, two, one. School, service areas, and economic development grants writer and the Community Research Center were the main things that prompted people to walk up to the microphone last night. Only 54 people got to talk to the Assembly about proposed budget cuts, while over 100 names are on the list to speak. The Borough Assembly is considering cutting the mayor's proposed budget by nearly $6 million and more than 40 borough jobs. The attempt to make cuts did get some support last night. There were four people who specifically supported the recommendations of the Finance Committee and some others who did commend the Assembly for their efforts to streamline the budget. There was also support for the Assembly's efforts to continue providing dumpster service for people who live outside the city limits. But the majority of the crowd there had a specific interest that they had come to protect. Support for the school district's full funding request of $22.3 million got the most comment, with a close second from Community Research Center advocates. Some of them said they'd pay more for the information the center puts out if that's what's needed. Borough Assembly members who want to eliminate the center say the borough doesn't need to be the group providing that service. Assembly members mostly listened last night. The later it got, the fewer questions they asked. Hank Bartow says the testimony will impact his thinking before voting on the budget.
I'm flexible, and, based on the testimony and the comments from the citizens, I'm willing to adjust my thinking. I think I'm not closed-minded at all, and I'm willing to hear what's going on and vote accordingly.
And Presiding Officer Paul Chismar, who missed the Finance Committee's weekend meeting where the budget cut recommendations were made, agreed with some of the people who say the cuts are more severe than the local economy warrants.
The bad times are leveled off. We've got to start looking ahead to the good times, the better times, and I'm confident the better times are coming. We're going to need the staff to lead us into those times.
In addition to public comment, Assembly members have lots of information to sift through before acting on the budget. That includes a 24-page impact statement from the mayor detailing what the budget cuts would mean for the borough. That came with a 2-page memo from Mayor Juanita Helms, in which she calls the cuts short-sighted and blasts the Assembly for making disparaging remarks about borough employees.
I put up with these kinds of comments for 3 years, and I have seen that it hasn't helped the borough employees at all, that once in a while they need to have somebody advocate on their behalf, and that's me.
In her memo, the mayor asked the Assembly to, quote, think about the fiscal ramifications of annihilating the morale of the employees of the borough and what that does to their performance. She goes on to say that voting cuts to a department as an experiment to cure a perceived illness is a cruel and cold-blooded act. There's still a lot of public testimony to be heard before the Assembly acts on the budget. At last night's session, the Assembly averaged about 8 people an hour early in the evening, but the crowd got thinner and testimony got shorter the closer it got to midnight. School Board President Jerry Macbeth was the last person they had time to hear from, and he had just started answering questions when the Assembly had to call it quits. They'll get to hear more answers when they try to finish the public hearing next Monday night, beginning at 6 o'clock. For KUAC Local News, I'm Ann Thornson.
Representatives from Exxon and Alyeska spoke to the Energy Committee at the Legislative Conference, but missing from the program were state representatives or environmentalists. State Senator Jan Fakes chairs the committee and turned down a request from Fairbanks Representative Mike Davis for a chance to speak.
He's not a member of the committee. First of all, he has not been assigned. You are appointed these committee memberships, and Representative Davis has never been a part of the committee, has never shown an interest in the committee, and so he wasn't on the agenda because mainly the agenda was set in December and January, and he never showed any interest in the agenda. So I'm afraid he has not been a participant at all in this whole process.
Yet Davis says that Fakes told him the committee was pro-energy, and they didn't want to hear about the problems caused by the spill. Problems played down by an official from Exxon. Davis feels it's too early for the optimism shown from Exxon over the cleanup.
There's a definite impact to having dumping that much in terms of hydrocarbons into an environment, and we don't know what the long-term impacts are going to be. And I think it's outrageous for an Exxon official to say, hey, look, there's no impact to the wildlife today that we know of.
Davis and Fakes were pitted against each other over Davis's oil spill legislation in the last session. Fakes claims she was opposed only to a small portion of the bill, but Davis says she strung it out to die. One representative from New Mexico carried the torch for Exxon this week here at the conference, saying The oil company needs support now after its cleanup costs. He asked people not to tear up their Exxon cards, but to order more. Davis shot back that even a pro-industry energy committee needs to be concerned when development takes place in an irresponsible manner. Davis is not running for re-election, so there won't be a similar showdown in the legislature. But he says the whole country is watching Alaska for its handling of oil spill laws, and they'll have to pass them soon. For Alaska Public Radio, this is Joel Anthony in Washington, D.C.
During the summer, we want to do some upgrading of the facility to bring it up to code. Our ability to do that will be dependent upon ability to find money, and we're in the process of doing that to make the thing fire safe and all of that. But our long-range goal, and my advisory board's long-range goal, is to continue providing emergency shelter to the homeless population of Fairbanks and this North Star borough. How we are able to find the funds to do that for the next fiscal year is a task that we're involved in, trying to find those, the dollars. This year we've been able to reallocate funds and bring the shelter dollars down, what it's going to cost us to operate the shelter down to $76,000. But we're not sure where that $76,000 is going to come from. There are several sources of funds that are potential sources. 50 to 70% of our clients are substance abusers in some kind of fashion. Those are the shelter clients, the people who need the shelter. Is there a possibility of some funds springing out of substance abuse money for emergency shelter? I don't know yet. That's something that we're looking at. 40% of our clients are Native population. Seems to me that the Native community has a responsibility. And maybe it's the Doyon, but we haven't been able to knock on that door right yet. But that's a possibility.
3, 2, 1. Talking about where to put a new city police station started off the evening. Without money to build a new station, though, council members are wondering if the discussion should go any further. That's when Councilmember Bob Sundberg first brought up his proposal for a sales tax to fund capital improvement projects in town.
I really think for capital projects within the city, streets, sidewalks, curbs, street lights, storm drains, projects that should be done and which are going to be identified for me by the city engineer, I think the city residents may well go for a sales tax if they can see the money being used for projects such as that.
Sundberg says the general sales tax he's thinking of would not be more than 3% and would not fund city operations, just capital improvements. The city usually issues bonds for major projects, and Sundberg says that's still an option if this idea doesn't have support.
When you're bonding, then you're paying back a considerable interest to the bonding companies over a period of years. Certainly the city could go that way. But I'll try the sales tax first, and if that's turned down, we may have to go to bonds, and then it's up to the citizens to encumber their property. Really, that's what you're doing when you pass a bond, rather than pay as you go with a sales tax.
Sundberg has asked that a sales tax ordinance be drawn up for city council approval soon. The council may have a big audience for its next meeting with a proposal on the table to restrict the hours that downtown bars can be open for business. The council is considering having downtown bars close at 2 a.m. instead of 5 a.m. That already brought out one downtown license holder who told council members that the change would shut his business down. But the council gave initial approval to the idea and may take final action in 3 weeks. By then, they'll also know who's interested in being city manager. The city will advertise the job, and the deadline for applications is to be June 8th. And the ad will only run in the Fairbanks newspaper. Mayor Jim Nordale.
To go farther than that is probably going to cost the council, council city a lot of money. And in all probability, there's enough interest out there that people will know from the Newsminer ad eligible candidates. And there are probably eligible people within the city or within the state of Alaska who, and the council's not interested in engaging in some sort of prolonged search that might go throughout the United States, I presume.
The agreement to advertise the job came after the council went into a lengthy closed meeting called to talk about the city manager vacancy. Before going into the meeting, they said personalities would be discussed, but didn't specify just who they would be talking about. Called into the meeting at various times were three city officials, including the attorney. while one of the private citizens waiting outside that meeting was former city manager Brian Phillips, who was recently turned down for another city job. The mayor and one council member said after the closed meeting, which was well over an hour long, that the only things that were discussed related to the city manager vacancy. For KUAC Local News, I'm Ann Thornson.
All I can say is I wish this body would make up its mind, just what do you want to do? I have spent a tremendous amount of time and energy on this budget, which is fine. I'm willing and happy to do it. But let's set one ground rules and follow through on them instead of all this shilly-shallying around.
I have been consistent in saying that what the Assembly needs to do is set policy. And setting policy doesn't mean you have to eliminate Joe Blow specific. It means you tell us what programs you think we don't want to operate, such as transit. Instead of saying, I want this person to go and this person to go, the Assembly should be straightforward and say, we want to quit complying with the federal government and wipe out the inspection and maintenance program.
3, 2, 1. After okaying all the cuts to the mayor's budget, Assembly members slowly are restoring some things. The purchasing director, for one, that job had been targeted by the Assembly's proposed cuts, but was returned to the budget last night, along with a couple other employees. Parks and garbage got a lot of discussion during the second night of budget sessions. The Assembly hoped to cut 8% off the mayor's budget for the Parks and Recreation Department, but Assemblymember Hank Hove felt some of the changes weren't necessary and proposed a much smaller reduction, prompting Joe Ryan to defend the original cut.
This department is not being adversely impacted with the Finance Committee recommendation. They still come out with a net increase. And everybody else in the borough, is, with the exception of the library, is getting whacked pretty good. Where are you leading this horse? Mr. Hove?
I think what we have to avoid here is making Simon Legree look like a tooth fairy.
The Assembly did restore some funding to the Parks Department and agreed to keep a manager for the aquatics program. Dumpster service in the borough will also continue under the Assembly's plan. Even though the mayor wants to remove the dumpsters that rural borough residents use, the Assembly made it clear that service is a priority. They funded more than $1 million to keep the dumpsters open. They also plan to run the landfill for only 6 months, hoping to try again at letting a private company operate the landfill during the second half of the fiscal year. And Assembly members changed their minds about giving a nonprofit organization money to promote recycling in the borough. Assemblymember John Davies originally had support for the $22,000 grant, but he fought for it again last night when a recommendation was made to drop the idea because it might compete with the private sector.
The volunteers right now are carrying all those materials to a private contractor. And all this would just help the volunteer group, help that private enterprise make more money. This whole thing right now is a marginal economic operation. If government doesn't play a role here, this whole problem of recycling will not get off the ground.
But Davies was in the minority, arguing against Assembly members like Donna Gilbert, who says the borough shouldn't be involved.
I'm certainly in favor of the recycling, John, but the point is that I got some calls on this, and there are people out there that feel that we are giving to a nonprofit in order to compete against people that are actually in the business.
The Assembly worked through seven more departments last night, agreeing to restore four jobs, the money to fund them, and several other smaller items. Several hundred thousand dollars was also added to the budget because of money associated with keeping the dumpsters. Perhaps the biggest budget debate comes tonight with the Public Works Department. The Assembly has proposed overhauling that department, cutting 12 jobs and reorganizing its structure. Local funding for education is also due for consideration. The Assembly wants to reduce the local contribution to the school district by nearly $3 million. Tonight's budget meeting could be the final one, with minor changes likely after the entire plan is adopted. For KUAC Local News, I'm Ann Thornson. Reporting from Fairbanks, I'm Ann Thornson. 3, 2, 1. Committee members voted Wednesday morning to recommend Denali Center's shutdown. Treasurer Red Porter says the center has lost close to $1 million in four of the last 6 years.
Handwriting's been on the wall that not only were we not keeping up with daily expenses, but we were not creating any capital. whereby we'd be able to make the place into the kind of a place that we would like it to be if we were going to continue to operate it.
Part of the problem is the state-approved Medicaid reimbursement that pays health care costs for most Denali Center residents. The Alaska Department of Health and Social Services sets that rate. Commissioner Myra Munson says this move is premature because Denali Center will be in the black this year.
With the rate that they're presently receiving, they must manage very frugally. They can't raise salaries. They can't accumulate money to meet the large capital need they have to replace the facility. But they can continue to provide patient care and to meet the needs of Fairbanks residents in their own community.
The Foundation's Board of Trustees is expected to meet in early June to review the recommendation. In Fairbanks, I'm Ann Thornton. 3-2-1. The vote of the Foundation Board's Executive Committee was unanimous. Foundation Treasurer Red Porter says without enough money to operate or repair the facility, there's no alternative.
Imagine how we feel. There isn't anyone on that board that hasn't been here for many years. When we read down a list of the patients, those are names and people that we're familiar with, personal friends in some cases, and we know the families in some cases. Now what? It's not a decision that's been taken lightly or easily. If we knew any answer other than what we have proposed, we would be trying it.
The foundation bought the nursing home in 1983 after private owners couldn't afford to keep it going. As a nonprofit facility, Denali Center has lost nearly $1 million over the last 6 years. But this year, the center is expected to operate in the black. But they don't have the money to repair or rebuild the center. The foundation wanted $10 million from the state legislature to do that, but that didn't happen. Porter has little hope that it will.
And that's the disheartening part of this whole thing, is that unless you can see some kind of a light at the end of the tunnel, it doesn't make a whole lot of sense to continue doing what we've been doing.
Medicaid pays for many Denali Center residents, but foundation officials say the money is not enough to cover the cost of health care. But the state's Commissioner of Health and Social Services disagrees. Myra Munson says it may be difficult to manage on Medicaid funding, but it can be done. Munson says foundation members are concerned about Denali Center's financial problems impacting the hospital operations, since the foundation owns both and hires the Lutheran Hospital and Home Society to run them both.
The foundation's mission isn't really jeopardized right now. The losses, the operating losses that have been experienced, are borne exclusively by the Lutheran Home Society under the lease agreement, and will be until September of 1993. So from my perspective, this is a precipitous decision entered into, I know, by very well-meaning people committed to Fairbanks, but I think making a decision that will have just drastically detrimental impact on people in Fairbanks. 80 patients and their families, more people who would come in, who would otherwise be admitted to a local nursing home, who will have to be transferred to a program somewhere else in the state or be deprived of appropriate care. And 140 employees.
And even though Porter says the foundation doesn't see any alternative, Munson says before shutting down the operation, they should pursue other options.
And they've not considered any possibility at this point of trying to work with other health care providers who would not necessarily see a competing mission to see if someone else might take over the nursing home. A new community group might form. Or some other health care provider in the state, local to Fairbanks or somewhere else, might be willing to take it over. They've not pursued that route.
With Denali Center the only place available in Fairbanks for nursing home care, Munson thinks it's important the community do what it can to keep the operation going.
To think about the city that I grew up in, where my mother lives, being without a nursing home, that friends of mine who might experience a severe injury and need nursing home care wouldn't be able to get that care in their own town. The people my mother goes to visit, which they wouldn't be there because they would be in Juneau or Ketchikan or Anchorage or Soldotna or Seward. That people flying in from interior villages, you know, who have their family members have to live away from their own home, won't be able to visit, and that family members won't be able to visit who live in Fairbanks. I mean, that is, the cost of that decision in people's lives is just unbearable.
The 25-member Foundation Board of Trustees will meet in early June to review the recommendation to shut down Denali Center. For KUAC Local News, I'm Ann Thornton. Reporting from Fairbanks, I'm Ann Thornton.
And I have looked at the changes that have been made over the last 3 years. Under Mr. Cross, the school district has reduced the number of administrative employees. The classroom pupil-to-teacher ratio has gotten better. And you talk about fiscally responsiveness. I looked at what the school district brought forward this year in their proposal. They're asking for the same thing they asked for last year. They did not inflate it or raise the amount.
Now, every year this school district budget is growing in increments of about the same thing. It's jumping up $5 million. My question is to all these people that love kids is, what's going to happen 10 years down the road and 20 years down the road when that budget keeps going up $5, $6, $7 million every single year? All these people that claim to love their children are doing nothing but right now stealing their future.
I would encourage this assembly to extract their head out of the sand or wherever else it's placed and get this thing squared away in a manner. I mean, it's absolute insanity to be eliminating the entire civil engineering department of this borough.